I've been going through these notes here, like that meme of Charlie Day from Always Sunny, where he's like got the he's like a psychopath. Because I was very interested in what after Star Wars: A New Hope, right? The world has fallen in love with this new thing, Star Wars. What was the first new narrative outside of A New Hope? And technically, it is the Star Wars comic book. Now, the first issue of Star Wars comic came out in April 77, a month before the film came out, which I did not know.
Yeah.
Which means the first seven issues of the Marvel line were an adaptation of the movie. So in April, you could have spoiled the first 1/7 of the film for yourself.
Okay.
But sorry, the first six issues. Then issue 7 was when they first started with finished the adaptation and started new stories.
New stories, yeah.
So issue 7 was January 78. January, February, March, April. Right. That's 4 months.
Okay.
The book we're talking about today came out April 1978. So there were 4 original Star Wars comics issues that were released before this.
Okay.
But this is the first quote-unquote sequel kind of that's released.
Yes. You're going to go into detail about that, the Star Wars comics and stuff, when we talk? You
know, well, I just wanted to share some of my madness with you.
Your research. Okay, yeah.
Let me say, this is PCMC. I'm Mike Mangiardo, and I'm joined today by Peter Marsh. You know Peter from his various YouTube endeavors and his illustrious publishing career. Pete, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, sir. I was wondering, does Pop Culture Man Children have like a wiki or Reddit?
It doesn't have a wiki or a Reddit, no.
Okay. Because I was wondering, like, with your fan base, do they kind of sit there and they go, oh, no, it's another episode with Pete? Oh, no.
No.
They're going to talk about Turtles again and Power Rangers.
We're not. I mean, unless later on we talk about the new Power Rangers special.
as long as we talk about The Last Jedi at some point, we know that we've done our job.
Well, we know we're going to talk about The Last Jedi because Alan Dean Foster doesn't like The Last Jedi.
Doesn't seem to, no.
But I tell you what he does like, sexual tension between Luke and Leia.
Who doesn't?
You know, I was talking to somebody about this earlier this week. I was like, you know, for the podcast, we're doing the first Star Wars expanded novel, which is now called Legends, Splinter of the Mind's Eye by Alan Dean Foster.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling them, like, yeah, there's like, first of all, Han Solo's not in it or mentioned once, but there's a lot of sexual tension between Luke and Leia. And they were like, oh, that's kind of weird. And I was like, yeah, but you got to think, like, if he only had the first movie to go off of, it's a totally normal thing to do. It's not until probably when he sees Return of the Jedi that he's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, he was shocked, I think, when Return of the Jedi came out. And he saw the two of them were siblings. You know, just to kind of put some context to it, with the idea of Star Wars, George Lucas wanted to be this ongoing saga. And, you know, they often say that he had everything planned out by A New Hope, but it's very clear that he didn't.
No way.
And then the next thing was that he wanted to actually have like 9 movies altogether. And there would have been a prequel trilogy. And then there also would have been a sequel trilogy, all done by George Lucas. Yeah. And the sequel trilogy would have introduced Luke's sister, who would have been a completely different character.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the Emperor wouldn't have been introduced in Return of the Jedi at all, but instead would be the main villain of this next trilogy.
Interesting. Yeah. It's very, very clear that he didn't have it all planned out. And whatever, it's fine. It worked out. I do think, and I've always thought this, Luke and Leia being siblings.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're trying to one up the twist from Empire of Vader being his father, but it doesn't work as well. It doesn't work as well. It just feels like an afterthought. It takes this interesting like love triangle and kind of like nullifies it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know that George Lucas was getting divorced by the time of Return of the Jedi, and I think that probably made him not want to keep making Star Wars movies. So I think that he tried to wrap everything up with Return of the Jedi, and so that's why the Emperor's in it. And I think that instead of it making it that Luke's sister was this brand new character, it was going to be that his, you know, sister was Leia. Yeah.
I recently saw an interview where he was talking about how he was going through his divorce when he made Temple of Doom, and he was like, that's why he rips his fucking heart out. Just like, she ripped my heart out.
That is the most passionate I've ever heard George Lucas ever be.
No, everybody was like, and that's why she took his heart out.
That's it. It rhymes. But it rhymes. You know, it's funny because thinking about this book, this sequel to Star Wars, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, written by Alan Dean Foster, you know, I think about George Lucas, and in a way, he's got all these dad issues, right? Like, Luke obviously is inspired by him, and Vader, I'm sure, is inspired by his own father on some level. But he's almost like all of our dads, too, right? Like, he fucking shaped our whole culture. This culture that you and I are in, that like kind of is the dominant pop culture, him. Like, he's the one that decided to make merchandising be such a big part of this franchise. And then besides that, the invention of this novel, I think that's really exciting because basically he thought that Star Wars is going to flop. Yeah. And so he wanted the story to continue. So he had Alan Dean Foster, who ghost wrote the novelization of Star Wars, write this novel as a sequel. And to me, it's so funny because that's what happens now. When like your Netflix shows get canceled, when your movie sequels don't get greenlit, someone makes a novel of it or a comic book, right?
Yeah.
So he's doing that in 1978.
Right. I mean, to think you've got this big movie, and sure, there's toys and comics and stuff, but for him to go, the guy that ghost wrote the novelization, because if you look at the novelization, originally it said written by George Lucas.
Right.
I'm going to get that guy and I'm going to kind of let him off the leash. I mean, it doesn't seem like, as controlling as Lucas became later, it doesn't seem like he's that controlling early on, because it seems like Alan Dean Foster is coming up with a lot of shit in this.
And there's stuff that kind of bleeds into Star Wars canon, right? Like the Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the title device, the MacGuffin, is this crystal, and it's a kyber crystal. And it's spelled differently than the way they spell it in canon now. But kyber crystals are what they use for their lightsabers in canon. But it's the focus of this book. It's like a crystal that enhances a person's force abilities.
Right. It's not exactly the same thing.
Right.
But it's the same name. You know what really shocked me? The use of the word Sith in this book.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, holy shit.
Like, I think that Vader is referred to as a Dark Lord of the Sith in the novelization of Star Wars, though.
So is that just something Lucas always had, or was that something Alan Dean Foster came up with?
Now, that is a really interesting question. I'm assuming Lucas had it. You know, the thing is, right, when you like live with Star Wars for your whole fucking life, right, you just pick up all these little nuggets and you don't necessarily know which source you got them from. But, you know, there's so many different weird things about Star Wars. Like, the first title is like, it's from the Journal of the Wills. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So, like, George Lucas was just making up terms left and right. And I think he probably came up with the Sith.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right. But what's interesting is it doesn't appear in the original trilogy. You don't hear Sith until the prequels.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this would show that it was around. It was there.
Yeah.
Even I believe in the, like, the prelude, like, the preface to the novelization, there's, like, they mention, like, Queen Amidala and things like very, very short. Like, they give some short, truncated version of the prequel story.
Oh, okay.
I might be wrong. I seem to have a memory of that and being, like, blown away by it.
Yeah.
So
Well, I mean, one of the most famous bits of Star Wars backstory that, like, I don't know if it's ever been like officially stated, but like, I don't think the twist of Anakin or being Darth Vader was the actual twist, or if there even was a twist. I think that
right.
Vader was legitimately a guy named Darth Vader
Yeah.
who betrayed Obi-Wan and killed Anakin.
Right. In this book, Vader is referred to as Grand Moff Tarkin's henchman. See, what's interesting to me about a Star Wars fan is while reading this book, I'm trying to forget everything I know, right? I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of what if I didn't know all this other stuff? What if I didn't know everything that Luke does and everything about his family and going back 1,000 years? What if I just had seen the first movie? And that's really the place to kind of approach it from. But you can't help but be completely interested in places where things are not canon. And I've made a list of some stuff that struck me as like, wow, that's so not canon. Like even like calling R2-D2 a D2 unit, right? Where we in canon we call them R2 units. Probably not necessarily wrong at the time, it just becomes wrong later on.
And for the longest time, this book was considered part of the expanded universe too. Like you started before we recorded, started talking about like what the expanded universe looked like from the beginning, right? It was the Star Wars comic from Marvel, and then this, right? And then you don't get another novel until 1991, where you have Heir to the Empire, which is
That
this.
true?
I mean, you have like the Ewoks cartoon and the Droids cartoon, and you have
Christmas special.
the Chris. Oh God! And you also have the Ewok movies, right? The TV
Yes.
movies, right? So you have things like that,
Caravan of Courage.
right? But as far as like stuff that has like straight up Luke and Leia and
Yeah.
Vader, you don't have anything like that. I mean, Vader's dead by Jedi, but right? But you
Right,
don't have
right.
anything until 1991. So.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, and people don't realize like before the prequels, the way that this franchise stayed alive was through those books.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of it, right? Is that Alan Dean Foster is kind of part of the Star Wars DNA. He wrote the novelization of this. He wrote the novelization of the movie. He also did The Approaching Storm, which is a prequel novel, and he wrote the novelization of The Force Awakens, right?
Right.
But I think the Star Wars novelist that I like the most and can relate to more is Timothy Zahn, who wrote the Grand Admiral Thrawn stuff.
I think if you look at the current canon, which the current canon uses the old expanded universe as like a farm league for canon ideas, they'll pick things out. So if you look at the current Disney established canon, a lot of it is Timothy Zahn. I mean, we just had the trailer for the new Ahsoka show come out, and you hear Thrawn say the line, Heir to the Empire, which is the name of his first novel. Right.
Yeah, and Coruscant, that's a planet that Timothy Zahn created. You know, maybe George Lucas had the idea of like the capital of the
Right.
Republic or the Empire, but Coruscant is Timothy Zahn. There's so many things that are like his babies, right?
Yeah.
But with Alan Dean Foster, I just wanted to point out that he probably influenced George Lucas on some level, and that his stuff probably got folded into Lucas's own
I agree.
ideas. And then like if you look at the other stuff that Alan Dean Foster has written, I did a little research before this.
Yeah.
He wrote like the novelization for Alien, Aliens, Alien 3. He did Terminator Salvation. He wrote a novelization of Dark Star, which is that movie
John
with like
Carpenter.
right. He did the Black Hole, Clash of the Titans. So he like
A bunch of Star
adapts.
Trek books. Yeah.
So he's definitely like a genre and like a guy that adapts movies in the sci-fi genre, right?
But no, there are things in this book. Well, there are concrete things in this book that are still part of canon, like the planet they go on, Mimban. That's where in the current canon, that's in Solo we see that planet. That's where Han meets Chewie in the current canon. But there are things in this book that I was like, was he thinking about this when he wrote Empire? Like when they're on that road and the road turns out to be a giant worm, I was like, well, this is a lot like when they're inside the asteroid and they think they're in a cavern, but they're really inside the, like there are things like that. Even this crazy woman, Hala, she's got a little bit of crazy Yoda to her,
Very good
right?
point.
Yeah.
I think that's what's interesting about this movie. I'm sorry, I called it a movie too. I don't know if we mentioned this, but this would have been the potential sequel to A New Hope if they made a low budget New Hope.
Okay, well, okay, so I have a question about that.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't know if I believe that.
Oh, for real?
That story has been, that story's all over, right? It's on the wiki page. I've heard it a bunch of times before, but I don't know, why would he farm that out? Also,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like that cheap. I mean, it's one planet, sure, and there's no space battles, but it doesn't seem like it would be that much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure. There's so much stuff that's just speculation by fans and hearsay. But one of the things that kind of makes it sound like it's legit is that they say that, they didn't put Han in the story because they weren't sure if they could afford Harrison Ford for
the
sequel.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Right?
That makes sense.
The actual setting of itself. So just to kind of give some credit where credit's due, I also watched a video on Star Wars Explained, which is this awesome Star Wars YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Mr. Sunday, his YouTube channel is great. He said the same kind of thing too, where they were talking about the planet itself kind of lends itself to a cheap budget because there's all this fog and swamp
right,
shit.
That's true. And it's basically, right, it's basically a jungle.
Yeah.
Right. It's pretty simple to do. Yeah. 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 I guess it would be cheaper for sure. Yeah.
When I read this book, I had that context in mind. And so I was kind of picturing a Roger Corman Star Wars movie with right. Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill in it.
Yeah.
And these weird creatures. I wanted to go back to one point that you made, though, where you said that they referenced this in Solo.
Yeah.
Because when you meet Chewie, when I was reading this book, I was like, wow, this is kind of like the scene where Han meets Chewie. It's the scene where Luke and Leia meet the two Yuzzums.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
Wait a minute. Are they meeting Wookiees? That's what I thought at first.
Right,
when
right.
I read
yeah.
that part. And then it was these Yuzzum creatures. And even those creatures are referenced in Return of the Jedi, right?
Right, right. Again, spelled differently.
Right, right. Yeah, I feel like George Lucas is like, oh, as long as we spell it differently, it's kind of my idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's Kyber with a Y now.
Right, right.
So let's talk about the narrative a little bit.
Please, yeah.
So it's right after, or, maybe a few months or so after A New Hope, Luke is a rebel. He's still an X-Wing pilot. And Leia is going to this planet to have this big underground meeting. It's this neutral planet, which is funny because that comes up again in his episode 9 idea of a neutral planet. It's this neutral planet that they want to have a meeting with the underground and kind of convince them to join the rebellion. So the planet is in, what's the name of the system?
I got that written down.
Sir Carpus?
Sir Carpus, yeah.
Sir Carpus. So they're supposed to meet on Sir Carpus 4, but she ends up crashing, I guess, on Mimbim, which is part of that system.
Yeah, it's Sir Carpus 5.
Yeah, so 5. And then when Leia starts crashing, Luke goes with her because he's basically her bodyguard for this mission. But also he's really into her. He's, they constantly talk about how beautiful she is and how she makes his blood boil. And, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. When she kisses him in the first movie, when they swing over, that's a romantic moment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they end up on this planet, and at first it seems like there's not much going on, and then they find a mining community, and it almost reminds me of an Indiana Jones movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a guy and a girl, they're kind of at odds with each other.
Right.
They go through all the tropes that those movies have, we gotta take our clothes off, don't look, don't peek, we gotta take our clothes off, and we gotta pretend to be a couple. And this is a very weird couple where he's owns her.
Yeah, he's beating her up. Yeah.
There's some weird sexism in the mind of Alan Dean Foster.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's even continued to this day, which we'll talk about his script treatment later. Yeah.
So they find this, it's actually, whereas A New Hope is kind of 3 days basically all put together.
Something like that.
This is weeks, because they'll be we walked for 7 days or whatever. So it's this odyssey kind of, and they meet people along the way. They meet this wild old woman called mm-hmm. Hala.
Right.
She can, she is a Force user, but not very strong in the Force.
Right.
They meet Grammel, who I actually think was a good character.
Yeah.
The Imperial. They meet two Yuuzhans, which are like big beast, like bear kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
R2,
yeah, him and Key.
Yeah. R2 and C-3PO are there, but do very little. He does almost nothing with them.
Yeah.
Even in scenes where C-3PO could be translating, he's not. So did you forget? Did you forget what this droid's one job is?
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that, like, with the world building, he was really excited about certain characters. I think he really was into Grammel, because Grammel kind of has a couple of big moments.
Yeah.
I think he really liked Hin and Key a lot, too, and
yeah.
Hala. It's so funny, like, having these new characters and having them interact with Luke and Leia, because even the way that they interact with Luke and Leia is different from what we see other characters in the canon do, right?
Yeah.
Like Hala kind of bosses Luke around. She calls him Luke boy all the time.
Yeah.
That kind of bothered me. I should also explain that there's no like audiobook version of this anymore.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, there might have been at one point, like an official one, but I had to find one on YouTube, and it was basically just a woman reading the book. And she almost sounded like she was from 1978 reading the book, on like an old tape recorder. And it just kind of sounded really cheesy. But modern Star Wars books do an amazing job. They have like sound effects and they play the Star Wars music when you listen to the audiobooks. This was a little bit of a challenge to get through.
Yeah.
But with these new characters and this new location, it's interesting because Alan Dean Foster's obviously coming from a like 70s sci-fi aesthetic, and it's something that's different from what Star Wars is. It just feels like something completely different.
Right. From the very first page, we begin in the internal monologue of Luke, and he's talking about the darkness of space and the loneliness of man. And it feels very 70s sci-fi. And I was like, whoa, this is a whole different vibe.
Yep.
From the vibe that we're so used to now is like, oh yeah, that's Star Wars.
Yeah. And like even when they talk about like the technology, they talk about like using tapes. And I mean, like, obviously he's going off of this idea of like, you know, this is what the technology would be like. But you know, in Star Wars, there's like specific things that they've established as like Star Wars materials, right? Like now they use holo vids
right
for Star Wars. Everything's a hologram. And in this they had like actual tapes they were using.
Yeah.
I mean there's tons of details like that where it's like, oh no, that's not what they say in Star Wars.
Right. I mean, one very interesting thing is that Luke has to recharge his lightsaber.
Right.
And he actually uses like a couple times he uses a blaster that he finds to charge his lightsaber.
Yeah.
It's not part of the new canon. I mean, when you put a kyber crystal in now, like it basically can go for thousands of years without being recharged. But it was interesting because it almost reminded me of like the web slinger with Spider-Man. Like there's a ticking clock of it might run out while we need it. Like he's like, oh, you know, Vader's coming. I got to make sure my saber's charged. And I was like, okay,
right. It
strikes you as very, very different, right? But
yeah. It's
not necessarily bad, I don't think.
No, I completely agree. Just the world building in itself. It's like you could tell that you need like the Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi to really solidify what Star Wars is.
Right, right.
You know, Star Wars has a feel and stuff, but it easily could have gone in different directions. And this book kind of shows one potential direction.
Yeah. I mean, there's little things too. Like at one point, Leia is talking about some planet. And she was like, yeah, if they knew... Oh, she's talking about Mimbin. And she's like, yeah, if they knew that the Empire had a secret mine here, they would quit the Empire immediately. And at some point, they say the rebel government. It feels like in this book, the Empire is not as strong and totalitarian as it is in the film series that comes. It almost makes it feel like it would be a total political option to just opt out of the Empire.
Yeah, which I think you're right.
You know... We now, like, we have all these things like Andor and all this stuff where it's like, no, it's like it stretches to every different socioeconomic level of everyone's life.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and we're going back to one of those hearsay things, But I think that even in the original version of like the prequels, like George Lucas's backstory, I think even the Emperor himself isn't this sort of dark, powerful, wizard-like character. I think that he's actually kind of just like a figurehead, and that like
Interesting.
all the Moffs and stuff are the ones that are actually in charge. You know, they really played up Grand Moff Tarkin, and I think that like that's kind of a good segue into talking about Vader. And I think, like you mentioned it before, that Vader was referred to as Tarkin's henchman. Vader is like so different in this.
Right, absolutely.
Like, and it's so fun because when you compare it to like what he could have been, you're like, oh my God, what he is like so much better than what he could have been. You
Right,
know,
right,
they
right.
really dodged a bullet. Like, he's sitting there and he's kind of like taunting them a little bit. He's like talking way more than he would.
Right, way more, way more. Like, his dialogue was way off. I always got the feeling that he actually, it pained him to speak. So he probably didn't do it as much, you know, that much. But here he's very quippy. He's very verbose. You know,
He's like playful. And Vader is like, as they've gone on in the Disney canon, because they've spent so much time with Vader in the Disney canon, he is just like a machine, like a killing machine.
But to give some credit to this book, I do like how malicious they make this Vader. You know, he's basically, they make a lot out of the scene we don't see in the original film where Leia is interrogated.
Yeah.
She talks about how, like, she's really, like, scarred from that and has, like, has PTSD from being tortured. And at one point when they're fighting Vader at the end, he's like, you know, I'll kill Luke fast, but you, princess, you know, I have more to do with you. It's, like, very sick.
Well, I mean, that scene is worth talking about, right? Because Leia gets the lightsaber at that point and faces off against Vader. And I'm pretty sure that Alan Dean Foster had no idea that Leia was Luke's sister. We've already kind of alluded to the idea that, like, no one knew.
Right.
So she wouldn't have any kind of force sensitivity.
Then she doesn't,
And she doesn't in this book at all. And then Vader essentially, like, he does that kind of thing that they do in movies where, like, they'll hit someone with a sword, but it's like a glancing blow so that they're cut. But they're not fatally wounded. And he keeps like burning her. And
yeah.
We talk about her having these like black burns on her body.
Yeah.
When he touches her with his lightsaber. And then that leads to Luke stepping up and essentially like being able to go toe to toe with Vader.
Yeah. I actually think that the book would have been better if there were more Vader in it. If they had brought Vader in earlier.
Yes. Agreed.
He kind of shows up in the last third and he's kind of there. But before he shows up, there's no real antagonist. It's more like this odyssey of like trying to get someplace.
Right, right. That Grummel guy or Grammel is in the background and he, you know, obviously eventually figures out who they are. But he's, you know, just sort of like a bureaucrat, like just an imperial bureaucrat. And I really like the scene when Vader kills him.
Right. Yeah.
And once again, Vader's like real verbal when he's talking to him.
It takes him a while. I was like, when he was mouthing off to Vader, I was like, wow, this is not the Vader I know. But then eventually he does kill him.
Yeah, I think he like cuts him in half, right?
Yeah, right. But I mean, think about Nita. He fucking kills that guy real quick.
Yeah. And the guy just like walks into his office and is like, sorry, and he just like chokes him.
Apology accepted.
Yeah, there's a comic adaptation of this book.
Yeah.
And I saw a panel and it shows the panel where like Grammel got cut in half by Vader. It's pretty sick for a comic book.
Yeah.
A Star Wars comic.
It's a violent book, actually. You bring up. It's a pretty violent book. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of dismemberment. Actually, Luke cuts off Vader's arm.
I know. That just blows my mind.
Right.
So I was listening to Star Wars Explained, the guy that runs that channel, and he was basically pointing out that the way that Vader is with Leia is like the way that he is in Empire Strikes Back with Luke, and that Luke is essentially like on his level in this book, and that Luke is able to chop off his whole arm, whereas in Empire he chops off Luke's hand, right?
Right. But think about it, Luke and Vader don't fight until Empire. So if you're reading this book, you're probably like, whoa. Right, it's the first time Luke and Vader have a lightsaber battle.
Yeah.
And it's different, but it's not necessarily bad. Vader even has sort of a version of Force lightning. He kind of makes like a Force, you know, globe of power.
Right.
That, like, they volleyball back and forth between each other.
Yeah, yeah. It's just so cool, like, where they could potentially go with him. And, you know, I guess the idea is that he could have come back for a sequel. But that was one of the complaints that people had about Kylo Ren, was that Kylo Ren continued to get defeated in every movie. So how could he be a real threat? And so if this book had been made into a movie, or if this was the direct sequel, it's like, okay, well, Vader got defeated in A New Hope. Then he gets defeated in this. You know, he wouldn't be much of a threat.
Right, right, right. No, that is true.
It's so much better when he just mops the floor with Luke in Empire Strikes Back. It's just like, what are you even trying? Right. He fights Luke with essentially one hand for most of the battle.
Right, because we now know, right, that he wasn't even trying to kill him. He was just wanting him to turn him.
Right. And like, you know, and this is going to become part of our discussion when we talk about Alan Dean Foster's script treatment for Episode 9. But Star Wars Explained, he was talking about how Luke seems to know a lot about the Force and is like a good fighter with a lightsaber, even though like he only was trained by Ben Kenobi. He wasn't trained by Yoda by the time of this book.
Right, right.
And so he was saying that that's the idea of like, once you're sort of turned on to the Force or you can access it, that you become like super powerful. And that was like a complaint that people have about Rey, right?
Right, but in this book,
Luke is kind of like the equivalent of Rey.
Right. Well, there's something they do in this book, which is very interesting, which they kind of do with Rey in The Rise of Skywalker, which is like other Jedi are inside of you. Like there's this, when Luke and Vader are fighting at the end, Luke says like, I'm Ben Kenobi.
Yeah.
And Vader's like, what do you mean? And like, as if it's almost as if like Obi-Wan is like possessing him in some weird way.
Yeah.
It's very different from what we end up seeing, which is like, you know, he appears as a vision telling him go to Dagobah and talking to him. Like that he's like inside of him, like giving him like guiding him in these weird ways. It's a different version of the way the Force works.
Yeah. Well, this book mentions Luke kind of saying like, okay, Obi-Wan Kenobi even die? You know, his body disappeared. And so maybe one of the ideas was that like Obi-Wan did literally go into Luke, like his spirit joined with Luke.
Yeah.
You know?
So I want to talk about the thing that I think to me maybe is, I don't know, it for me works the least in this book. And it might be because of the rest of Star Wars canon. It's hard for me to accept it. Mm-hmm. The depiction of Luke and Leia, I feel, are very off. And especially Leia.
Mm-hmm.
They make it a snobs versus slobs. I'm a street smart farm boy and you're an uptight prissy princess. She acts, they remind me more of Lone Star and Princess Vespa from Spaceballs.
Yes.
Like, it's as if Alan Dean Foster saw the original film and saw Leia acting the way she is, and instead of saying, oh, look how brave she is, he kind of was like, oh, look at what a brat she is.
Mm.
He writes her as bratty in this. And he writes Luke not so much as like G-Shucks farm boy, like very naive. He writes him more as like street smart. There's actually, I think, a lot of Han in this version of Luke.
Yeah. Really, really good observation. And I think that just kind of shows the different path that was at least established with A New Hope, where it's like, okay, you could have gone in this direction. And yeah, I do think that they probably were trying to get some of that kind of that charm and that banter from Harrison Ford and Han Solo into this without him being in it. But, you know, you got to think of Princess Leia, the character, and how over time she's changed pop culture, right?
Yeah.
Like when there was this, first of all, when Carrie Fisher died, it was like she became this gigantic feminist icon, right? But even when the idea of feminism was sort of being targeted, Princess Leia herself was used as an iconic image. Like, we're rebels, we're fighting back against the establishment.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that kind of affects how we think of Leia. But, it kind of took time to get to that point. You know, because even in Return of the Jedi, she's, like, in a bikini and shit, right?
Right, right. Well, that's the thing that's interesting about looking at something like this is, going off of the first film, I wouldn't necessarily say that what he's doing here is a huge leap.
Right, exactly.
I mean, I think that he doesn't do her a service. you know, she is very snotty. She does, you know, make fun of, she does talk back in the first film, you know, but I always read her as being more assertive. Whereas, you know, there's a scene in this book where they're trying to blend in with the miners and Luke has to like teach her how to walk like a person. He's like, "You're walking too much like a princess."
Right. That's
and
in the
there are points where she like mouths off to people and it's like, this is like, it just strikes me as like, well, I mean, it strikes me as not being her character, but even if forgetting that, right? Forgetting that bias, it strikes me as like not smart. Like, if you're trying to blend in, why are you speaking like you're a royal?
Right, right.
If you're trying to blend in, why are you having, like, a fucking mud fight? Like, there are things that the characters do that I find very stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that maybe it might just be a situation of, like, kind of just trying to move the plot forward, right? Sure, yeah. Because, like, the mud-pushing scene, for instance, right? It's like, first off, to give it context, Luke essentially smacks Leia in the face at one point because people think like they're starting to question the fact of like who she is. Like she's in this mining, she's wearing mining, an outfit of a miner. Right.
Yeah.
And they take note of how like delicate her hands are. And they're like, she can't be a miner. And so then like Luke says, oh, she's my property. She's my slave. And he like smacks her in the face. And then outside of the bar, she pushes him into the mud and then they fight. And then these other people, these miners show up and then there's a scuffle and that's what kind of gets them on the Imperial's radar. So I think it's sort of like a matter of just kind of moving the plot along.
You needed to
along.
Get them there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that scene is Luke takes out his lightsaber and then in our current canon, it would out him, right? Like only Jedis use lightsabers. But in this book, you would think that lightsabers are common.
Right, right.
Like nobody seems to bat an eye at the fact that this guy has a lightsaber.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite parts that are like when you see contradictory stuff in Star Wars lore, I kind of like when there's that inconsistency with the Jedi and how the Jedi were viewed and what the Clone Wars were. I love that kind of stuff. And yeah, this book is just like filled with that.
Yeah, yeah. Something very cool that's very different is there's a scene where Luke basically uses the lightsaber to pick a lock. Because... he takes out his lightsaber and he starts like playing with the knobs and the blade becomes like thin and he's able to like put it through a door to like break the handle. I like the idea though. I mean, it kind of makes sense like that, like those knobs could like make the blade bigger, tall, you know, shorter, fatter, wide. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah. I like the idea of a lightsaber as a tool a lot better than like this sacred weapon that it's hard to wield, right? Because that's one thing that gets a little confusing with me is like, oh, can people that aren't Jedi not use a lightsaber? Because essentially it's like a laser on a, in a hilt, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I like the idea that of a lightsaber having like multiple purposes. And that just kind of goes along with him writing it where you have to recharge it. You know, it's just like a fucking electric
drill.
It feels
more real in a way, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
See, with a lightsaber, I like the idea of, like, the kyber crystal inside the lightsaber being, like, attuned to the person, and somehow that person's able to use the lightsaber. I like that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, like, it just seems like anyone could use them.
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think there's so little to do for R2 and C-3PO?
I think that, okay, well, probably from a... If we're doing like practical and the idea that they were going to make like a cheap sequel to Star Wars, like a cheap movie sequel, then the less stuff that R2 would have to do, it would be cheaper to make, right?
Right, right, right.
You know, and just having them kind of as background characters might just, like, maybe you don't have to have a guy in a suit for 3PO. You could just kind of prop the suit up against the wall and he's there, you know?
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny because like 3PO actually has like a really big part in episode 9 written by Alan Dean Foster.
Yes.
So you'd think like, you think that 3PO is one of his favorites.
Right. What did you think of the scene where they're underground and like they meet that, the Co-ways?
Yeah. Those aliens. Yeah.
Yeah. And it feels a little bit like the Ewoks. I mean, they're more violent and they look different, but the way that like they capture them and they have to win their favor felt very much like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because I looked at the pictures for the comic book adaptation of this book, and they drew them just like the mole people from Marvel's Fantastic Four comics. Like there's Mole Man, and he's in charge of this underground society, and it looks just like them. I wonder if that was the inspiration for the characters in the book, you know? But yeah, it just sort of fits with the Star Wars aesthetic, right? You find this sort of primitive culture. In the first movie, it's Jawas. In Return of the Jedi, it's Ewoks. And you know, they're not in Empire Strikes Back, but there's like cultures like that throughout the whole saga, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was interesting reading along, thinking like, can you find analogs from the first movie in this? Like taking the first movie almost as a template. Like I said, Hala's a little bit like Yoda, but in some ways, Hala's like Obi-Wan.
Yes, oh
I
yeah.
mean, she's very different, right? She's the opposite. She's this curmudgeonly old woman, but she's an older figure that's guiding this very young, naive guy. He puts his trust in her immediately. She
Yeah.
can use the Force, but she's not benevolent the way that Obi-Wan was.
No. Yeah, and I mean she's just kind of like a plot device in a way because she's getting them to the crystal and she's kind of taking them along on their adventure and she's the one that can essentially get them off planet too. But I don't know. Like everything here feels less than what's in the movies. And maybe just because the movies have this like mythical status for us,
Sure, yeah.
you know?
Yeah, for
Like
sure.
everything kind of seems disposable from the aliens that we just talked about to her, you know?
Right. Well, let me ask you, in general,
Yeah.
did you dislike this book? Did you like it? Are you happy you read it?
I guess I'm happy I read it because anytime I can read Star Wars books, if they're expanded universe or whatever, I'm happy, right? I read so many Star Wars expanded universe books that was like the thing I loved to read when I was like 12 years old and up, right? But the actual process of reading it was not very enjoyable. Like I listened to this woman reading it on YouTube and just like the language that was used and like the way the plot moves, it felt like a slog, honestly.
It does, yeah, it no, it totally feels that way. I
Yeah.
enjoyed it, but it does feel like a slog. And then
Yeah.
it and then Vader kind of shows up and it's like, okay, I guess we're wrapping things up.
Right. Yeah, one of the major problems of the Star Wars expanded universe, I felt from reading so many of the books, was that there was a lot of like, you know, debating and politics because the New Republic was being reformed, right? And I
Yeah.
always felt like, okay, here we go. Let's just get through this, and then we'll get a cool Jedi sequence. And there is a little bit of that in this where they're with Grammel and he's like talking to them, and it seems like there's like posturing, but it's so much more of an adventure, like just like you said before, like Indiana Jones or like Romancing the Stone
Yeah,
kind of
Romancing the
adventure.
Stone, yeah.
Yeah. But what I was gonna say was that the dialogue in this book also felt like it wasn't like it didn't feel natural at all. Like the characters didn't really feel like they were having actual discussions. It just kind of just felt like they were just kind of describing the plot.
But do they, is it natural in Star Wars?
No, especially earlier Star Wars, it's pretty clunky and, you know, inauthentic seeming, but you know, it gets better over time. And Han
Right.
Solo certainly makes it seem more
Right. He
that's
makes
one.
things work.
Right. I can't remember which like video YouTube channel had it, but they were basically like Han Solo is like the regular person that says things the regular way, you know?
Right. And he doesn't believe in the bullshit.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So let's see. I just have a little list here.
Yeah.
Okay. Referring to Darth Vader as a henchman. Tapes, they say tapes a lot. I mean, they
Covered
do
that.
say tapes in A New Hope. They say, you know, the stolen tapes will not, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
A member of the Imperial family, he says to Leia, you got to look like a minor, not a member of the Imperial family, which makes me think they had no idea of like there being an emperor or if it was a dynasty or what it really felt like.
Exactly. And that's actually really intriguing to me. I like the
Yeah.
idea of like what could Star Wars have been if there was an Imperial family and not
Yeah.
just like Emperor Palpatine, you know?
Right. And then they use the word aboriginals, which is not incorrect. It's not incorrect. I mean, in the
Right.
definition is, you know, the original inhabitants of a world, but it's not used in Star Wars otherwise. So every time they would say aboriginals, it was just like it's just little things like that strike you as like, It shows how strong it is as a brand that things feel like they fit or they don't. And that could be a problem, right? Because I feel like inside the fandom, a lot of the fights people have is whether or not something feels like Star Wars or not. You know, like, oh, Leia flying doesn't feel like Star Wars, or, you know what I mean? Things like that.
Yeah. But that in itself is really interesting too, right? Because when you get to like force powers, it gets a little bit, you know, it's kind of murky. It's kind of hard to say, like, well, would this happen? Would this not? But I do feel like the world building of Star Wars, when it comes like the practical stuff, like the tools and the ships and the clothing, yeah. I feel like Star Wars has a specific aesthetic that when you look at it, you're like, that looks like Star Wars. You know,
that feels like Star Wars. Right, you know? Because using an example that's not The Last Jedi, a lot of people didn't like Boba Fett's little, like, gang of enforcers in the Boba Fett show.
Right,
people said they, like, it looked like they were driving, like, real-world motorcycles. And they looked like powery. They were too colorful in a way. I thought they were cool, but I totally understand it does stand out.
Yeah, it didn't fit on Mos Eisley, at least, or Tatooine, you know? It just felt a little weird.
Like, Cyberpunk, there's no Cyberpunk on Tatooine before. Right. Everyone was just wearing robes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem, right? Is that people have conflicting views about Star Wars and what fits canon and what doesn't. And this book obviously is like totally left of center. It's like different from what we've expected. But I think it just kind of makes me appreciate what has come after it, you know?
Yeah. There's a moment that Leia is sleeping and they're cold and they're cuddled up together and Luke almost kisses her while she's asleep.
Yeah.
It's pretty problematic.
Yes, yeah.
Cancel, I mean, Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, it's a different time, man. You know, like there's stuff that like romantic stuff in this book that just kind of creeps me out.
Yeah. So you want to talk about Alan Dean Foster's treatment for his idea of an episode 9?
Oh boy, do I. That's kind of what I've been wanting to talk about in all this book. do you want to give the context of this?
Sure. Well, I have to give a huge amount of credit to the YouTuber Jenny Nicholson, who I love her stuff.
Me too.
She did a great video about this where she kind of read through it. But basically, before The Rise of Skywalker episode 9 came out, some outlet asked a bunch of writers of Star Wars, hey, what would you put in your episode 9? And Alan Dean Foster was like, didn't answer, but he was like, you could go to my website and see I wrote my own treatment for what I thought episode 9 should be.
Right.
So she goes and she reads, and his website's like, looks like 19, like GeoCities, like 1990. Like, I actually went through it today. It hasn't gotten any better since she made that video.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And if you don't know what a treatment is, by the way, a treatment is like sort of a short story version of a film. A treatment kind of reads like somebody telling you a movie. Like, right. If you had a friend that was like, and then this happened, and then that happened. That's how a treatment, and it's used in Hollywood as a way to go through material quickly because you could read a treatment much quicker than you could read a whole script.
Exactly.
So he wrote a treatment for episode 9, but the thing is, what you clearly see when you read it is, he's on the dark side. He's one of the people who really does not like The Last Jedi, and he tries to undo everything Rian Johnson did, which is also what they did with the actual Rise of Skywalker.
Right.
He does it in much weirder ways. Like, the headline would be Rey's kind of a robot.
Yeah.
And clones. There's a million Snoke clones.
Oh, yeah. It's basically like wish fulfillment for all the people that didn't like the choices made in The Last Jedi.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's weird because Jenny Nicholson says this in the video. And also for you guys that are listening, like, I highly, highly recommend you check this video out on Jenny Nicholson's channel. She's great. It's long, but it's like super interesting. Like every single complaint, every nitpick that we would hear about for years after this fucking movie, it's like he like course corrected essentially. And it's weird because, and she points this out in the video, that he essentially like retells The Last Jedi, but just makes things go a different way.
Right. He just redoes it, but worse.
Right. The weirdest thing. And so, okay, what's really interesting is reading this treatment and reading this book and seeing it as like, oh man, this guy was at the very beginning. He wrote the novelization for George Lucas, and now he's like right at the heart of the controversy that is the bane of this franchise, right? And so it's like, this is how I would do my Star Wars. And I think that he really wanted Snoke to be something. Like, Snoke is such a big part of this movie. It's bizarre.
And Snoke dies in Kylo Ren kills Snoke in The Last Jedi. So he
Right.
undoes that. He has Snoke be a clone. Now, he was kind of prescient in a way because we do find out, at least in, what they retconned in Rise of Skywalker, that he is a clone.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, him being a clone ends up being now a really big part of canon because what do they call it? Operation
Necromancer.
Necromancer is basically trying to use Grogu, trying to take DNA from Grogu, Baby Yoda, and use that to create a body for the Emperor to come back.
Well, not to go off on like a Mandalorian tangent, but I think that Operation Necromancer is different from what they were going to do with Grogu. I think with Grogu, they were going to take his DNA and mix it with Moff Gideon, and Moff
Right, that
Gideon
was
was
hi
going to,
okay,
that was
yeah.
his thing.
At some
Okay.
point, Gideon goes off and does his own thing and it's like, fuck Palpatine, I want to clone myself.
Right,
Right, so I'm not sure exactly when and where that happens. Because if you're trying to bring back the Emperor, you would want somebody with a high Midichlorian count.
exactly.
But yeah, basically, I guess basically what I'm saying is we do find out that he is a clone. So
Yeah.
he kind of was right in a way, or he made the same retcon choice that J.J. Abrams made.
Right.
But basically, like in a very cheesy way, like he comes
Oh.
through a door and he's like, ha ha, I'm Snoke. And then
Yeah.
Kylo Ren kills him again. And then another Snoke comes out and he's like, ha-ha, there's many of me. And Jenny Nicholson makes the point like, well, they're not a hive mind. Like, each one is its own living thing. So, like, why is that Snoke so ready to die just to, like, make this point?
There's so many clones of Snoke in this movie. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, at the end,
And
it's like Luke. Yeah, at the end, it's like the main characters from this series. Poe, Finn, and Rey are
yeah.
barely there. It's Luke Skywalker fighting like a bunch of Snokes.
Yeah, he's fighting like 50 Snoke clones. And at one point, Luke has two lightsabers and he spins. And I think it's even described like a whirling dervish fighting Snoke clones. And that would have been so awful. I think I might have died if I was actually watching that.
You
But
imagine though?
the reason why I wanted to bring up this though is because it ties in with the splinter from the mind's eye, because Obi-Wan disappears and they're like, well, where did Obi-Wan go? And then in this weird treatment that Alan Dean Foster wrote, he says that like Luke returns. And when Luke returns in this movie, in his treatment, it's just like when Luke shows up in The Last Jedi, he just shows up. And then the explanation for Luke kind of vanishing in the end of The Last Jedi is that he was near to death, but he decided to go to some place that was like in between death and life. And then he came back to life. And it's like the cheesiest kind of retcon idea you can think of,
Just
but
to
it
die
brings Luke.
again at the end of this version.
Right.
He brings him back to kill him again.
And he dies just like he does in The Last Jedi, too. Yeah.
But no, he has
but
that weird backstory with Obi-Wan.
that's, we have to mention that, man. That's gold right there.
Yeah, it's crazy. Please, good talk about it.
Yeah. So, okay. This movie, this treatment by Alan Dean Foster, the writer of Splinter of the Mind's Eye, is replete with flashback sequences and montages, which are not very common in Star Wars, right? And so, in one of the flashback sequences, we see that Snoke was this powerful force user, probably a Jedi, and that he was turning to the dark side. And he goes and he fights Obi-Wan, who's like prequel Obi-Wan. And Obi-Wan wants to turn him away from the dark side, but then he falls into a vat of chemicals, kind of like the Joker.
Yeah, they're in a factory. They're in a Star Wars factory.
Yes. And it's kind of funny too, right? Because doesn't Obi-Wan create Vader by Vader falling into lava?
It's
So it's.
exactly like Batman. All I could picture is like Grisham coming in and being like, oh my God.
So Jenny Nicholson makes this beautiful point, which is that Snoke is able to clone himself, So, like, his disfigurement is not genetic. So,
Right.
wouldn't he clone himself to be like good looking and young?
Yeah.
Yeah, but
So
it's no,
wait.
it's
Yeah.
this ugly old gross Snoke,
Right.
and he's come back to get his revenge on the galaxy, and that's really the focus of this whole movie.
Right. All right. So I don't want to give Alan Dean. I don't hate him, and I did, and I actually enjoyed reading this book. So,
Yeah.
but I so I don't want to give. I don't want to be hard on him, but I also don't want to be too lenient with him.
Sure.
But let me suggest something. Is it possible that he didn't really take this that seriously?
The
Because
treatment.
yeah, because the level of writing there is not the level in Splinter of the Mind's Eye. I mean, it reads like fan fiction.
I agree
Could he
completely.
have been half joking? Maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
I don't know. We'd have to like see interviews and stuff with him to see how he talks and how he talks about Star Wars. Maybe if he has some blog posts where he's like really ripping into Rey and stuff like that. Because one thing that we should mention too is that he comes up with an explanation for why Rey is so powerful.
Oh,
And
what such bullshit.
it's the dumbest fuck. I mean, I can't even believe it. This maybe gives credibility to your theory. Because basically the idea is that Rey is part droid. She has a
Right.
droid, half of a droid brain.
Yeah.
Because when she was a child, her parents were drinkers, like Kylo Ren says in The Last Jedi, but they loved her enough to get a mad scientist to put a droid brain in her skull
Yeah.
because she had a deformed skull and, like, I guess missing part of her brain. And
Right.
so what happens is Kylo Ren fights her in this horrible treatment, and he cuts her head, coincidentally, right where her droid brain is.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why she's so powerful, because she's got the processing power of a droid and the force, you
Right.
know?
Which,
It's so bad.
first of all, it makes no sense because we've never, and Jenny Nicholson makes these points. Since when, why would being a droid make you good at the Force? That's not something that they've ever done. And
Yeah.
also, look at Darth Vader. This is a world where people have augmentations that are technological. So, like, her being, like, they wouldn't be like, oh, she's part droid. They'd be like, oh, she has, like,
His implant.
like, it's, what it is it's speaking to the fans that were like, she's a Mary Sue. How could she be
Right.
so powerful?
Right. And they totally just write her off. They have this revelation that she's part droid. It's really just to explain how she's so powerful, but then she doesn't have any kind of big climactic part of this movie. She's been the
No.
main character for two movies now, and in this movie, her like moment of truth is when she throws Luke's lightsaber to him to
Right.
fight Snoke,
Right.
one of the Snoke clones. And one thing I also wanted to point out too is that Kylo Ren is completely downplayed in this movie.
Sure,
He
yeah.
fights her at the end, and then he essentially just kind of like walks into her lightsaber and like skewers
Yeah,
himself,
yeah, yeah.
right? And Alan Dean Foster makes it a point to say that he died like Han Solo did, where like Han Solo gets stabbed through the stomach, essentially.
Yeah.
But it seemed like he didn't have he had some disdain for the new characters and just wanted to bring back the
Sure.
old characters.
You bet he did. But
Yeah.
and this is another way to tie these two things together.
Yes.
I think what you see in his feelings for Rey and the way he treats Leia is, a disdain for females or a disdain for strong female characters.
Yeah,
Leia is made to be humbled in this book. She's smacked by Luke. She's tortured by Vader. She's beaten brutally by Grammel. She runs her mouth and then he like beats the shit out of her. She takes so much physical and emotional abuse. It makes like as a, it's a real bummer because as you're reading, it's like, do you hate Leia? Do you hate women? And it seems like his feelings for Rey are not that much more evolved.
I wouldn't be surprised if he kind of makes some misogynistic comments online, or if he has things like that. I mean, I don't want to speculate about the guy,
Right,
because
right,
all I know
right.
is his fiction. I mean, obviously this is posted on his website, so you could read the script. But yeah, there definitely is this sense of like the female characters shouldn't be as powerful. That's for sure.
Right,
They're
right,
definitely like
right.
cut down.
Right. She acts in the splinter of the mind's eye more like Princess Vespa from Spaceballs. She's stuck up. She thinks she's better than other people. She lords over people. There's even a moment where she almost says, "Do you know who I am?" Like a,
Yeah.
do you know who you're talking to? Which,
Yeah.
I don't get that from Leia in A New Hope. Like, she takes the gun from, Luke and starts shooting the stormtroopers and says, come on, someone's got to get us out of here. And, she tells Chewbacca, like, get this walking carpet away from me. But it's not because she's a snotty person. It's because she sees, like, how fucking low rent Han is. Like, this is such, like, a bootleg fucking rescue. She's, like, going to help them.
Yeah, before I kind of said how Leia is like this iconic character and she's become this like feminist icon. The reason why Leia and then I think like maybe Ripley and maybe even to a lesser extent Sarah Connor are these like iconic female sci-fi characters is because of their nature to like get things done. And it's like regardless of their gender, they're like, no, this is what has to be done. And I think Leia's, obviously chronologically the first one to do that out of all those characters.
Right.
And in A New Hope and then the following movies and then in the expanded universe, it's always like, this is what has to be done. This is the right thing. And I mean, she shows like a little bit of prissiness and stuff in like The Empire Strikes Back, for instance.
Yeah.
Like when she's with Han. But for the most part, it's always like, I can handle this myself. That's kind of like the main thing. And with Alan Dean Foster's thing is like, it's not, I can handle this myself. It's like, Luke can handle it for me. And that happens in both things, the movie treatment and this book.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you were saying before that he wrote novelizations of the Alien movies. I wonder how his Ripley comes off.
Yes. I actually was wondering the same thing. I mean, obviously, we're sort of talking negatively about his potential misogynistic views.
Well,
right?
we're doing it critically because all we have to go by is the text that he's written and we've read.
Right.
That's
exactly.
That's where it's coming from.
Yeah, he must be like a consummate professional and his writing must be pretty solid, across the line because he's written for so many franchises.
Yeah.
I just would like to see what his online presence and stuff is like. But yeah.
Yeah. Part of me would like to check out like his Alien novelization. Just on a total side note.
Do it.
I always thought that would be such a fun job to be someone who does novelizations. I know that in the world of publishing, people think of that as like one of the worst things you could do. Like, oh, you just take movies. And to me, it seems like the most fun thing to do. Like, I would totally be happy if you were like, you could have a career. And what you do all day is like you write novelizations of movies, especially if they're movies I like. You know what I mean? Like I'd be like, that's great. What a great life. That to me, that sounds awesome.
I agree. The very first novels that I read as a kid were adaptations of movies. I think I read like an adaptation of like Hook. I think I read like at least one Star Wars novel. I read books based on the movies before the movies came out just because I was so excited to see the movie and that was a big thing for me. There's this one company, this one publishing house called Encyclopocalypse, and one of the main things that they do is they adapt movies into novels, but they usually pick movies that you would never picture them making into a novel. One of the most recent ones is like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. They made a novelization of the movie.
I'm not aware of this at all. This sounds really interesting.
So Encyclopocalypse, like encyclopedia, but apocalypse, right?
Okay.
And Sean Dureger is one of the main guys there. He's a guy does audiobooks, right? But he's like one of my contacts there, and I've gotten a lot of guests from my channel for interviews. And like one of the guys I had on, he wrote a novelization of this book. He wrote a novelization of the movie Manborg. Have you ever seen Manborg?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen Manborg.
Have you ever seen Psycho Goreman?
No, but I know what it is. I know what it is. I'm familiar with it.
The Manborg is like a movie that was made by the same people that made Psycho Goreman.
Okay. That's such a fun idea. That sounds like such a great idea. And something that I'm glad you agreed to do this with me because I've been wanting to do this for a while.
Yeah.
Because I have a bunch of other things I want to do too. Like, there's a sequel to E.T. called E.T. and the Green Planet. I've always wanted to read that and do an episode on it. There's also a, and I have this too, a Gremlins novelization, but it's based on the first script where they spoke. So in this novelization, the Gremlins all speak. So it ends up being very different from the final film. And yes, that's one of the cool things, because often in the whole process of how they do it is they'll give the first couple drafts, whatever they have, to the novelizer and say, okay, work off this. But as the script will change in the movie making process, they've written based on something else. So sometimes you have these really interesting things, like, you know, Gremlins that can talk.
Yeah, I love stuff like that. I love seeing the changes that they made. And often it's usually for the better, right? I always kind of view it as like the changes that they made the product better. And for movies where they didn't make those changes, those are kind of like the B movies and the duds. But like Gremlins is a great example, because I know that like in one draft, they like kill the mom in that scene where she gets attacked by the Christmas tree.
Yes.
And I know that like in one draft of Gremlins, like Gizmo becomes like the main villain, like
right
or whatever, you know. So I love when they actually have like a full viable story like that. And I think Encyclopocalypse, you should definitely check that out. That's one way
I
to
will
go. I mean, that honestly, that's like almost like a YouTube channel or a podcast in itself, like these alternate takes, just like this book. This is the Star Wars that could have been.
Right. I think it fits very well in some of the conversations we've already had on PCMC. Because like when we spoke about Masters of the Universe, you know, there's we live in this world where canon is very, very important now. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Canon is very important now. And I like things on the fringes of canon. I like, you know, as much as people used to say, like, George Lucas was so strict, he allowed for a lot of things. You know, he allowed, like, things to just go off and do something. Like, it doesn't matter if I undo it. Like, in the world, the Disney canon is much more strict than it was under Lucas.
Yeah. I mean, they have a council. They have a bunch of people who their entire job is to make sure the continuity works between the shows, the movies, the video games.
Right. You know? Right. And it could lead to bad decisions.
Yeah, it just kind of makes kind of a more vanilla product, right? Because everything is, one vision. Yeah.
Right. When J.J. Abrams wants to blow up Coruscant and they say, no, you can't do that. So they go, okay, it's this different planet, Hosnian Prime. It's like, okay, well, the impact of blowing up Coruscant would have been huge for the audience of Force Awakens. But, you know, it was vetoed.
Exactly. Yeah. Really good point. Yeah. But that's also the beauty of a novel like what we just read, is that the books expand on what's in the movies too. And like, I know that you read that book, Bloodline, for instance, which is about Leia, and it's about Leia being powerful, right? Because she's trying to bring back the Republic. And they kind of explain the whole Hosnian Prime situation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, you know, you and I, we kind of have said a bunch of negative things about this one book, but Star Wars canon has always been like one of my favorite things in my life, you know, just reading Star Wars books. And I don't want to dissuade people from checking out Star Wars books if they get a chance.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you tell us what's going on your channels? What's going on with your writing?
Sure. You got it, my man. So I have a website. It's prmarsh.com. And that's kind of the easiest way to find all my stuff. I have two channels that you mentioned. I have the LasserCast, where me and my friend Danny talk about the current horror movies and TV shows. Examples include Yellow Jackets. We're reviewing that right now. We're going to talk about Evil Dead Rise on Sunday morning. Besides that, me and my friend Brian, we have a channel called Comic Books Transformed, where we talk about TV shows and movies that are adapted from your favorite comics. Nice. And so on there, we just covered The Mandalorian. I know a lot of your fans are probably fans of The Mandalorian, if you guys want to check us out. That's on YouTube, and that's wherever you can find podcasts too. And then I have an Amazon page, which you can find via my website. But I'm using Kindle Vella to put out my novel, which is There's No Way This Is Right. And episode one of that, they do them like episodes on there.
Interesting.
That's available on Kindle Vella right now. If you guys want to give that a read, that would make me really happy if you guys could give that a read. Awesome. But yeah, and then like the last thing is I also have a Substack. And everything you can find just by looking up PR Marsh. If any of the things I said today were interesting, check it out.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here. This is PCMC. We come out every single Wednesday without fucking fail. We're slowly approaching episode 300, which is, I don't know if I've done 300 of anything in my life. Besides maybe like shit. We end every episode by saying, go bye-bye.
Go bye-bye.